most people today get about 60% of their calories from just three foods. When we think about what we buy at the grocery store, we buy and eat the same things every day. We talk about, these food reps, right? Or my go-tos. And it's for ease, it's amazing. But for health, we really need to broaden our horizons, expand our palate, and eat a diversity of foods and eat seasonally. That's a great way to try different things.
What's up, folks? Welcome to episode 13 of Coming Up Podcast. I'm Matt Schumacher. Our guest this week is Devin Delaney, the holistic nutritionist and director of high performance nutrition at one of the most elite ski academies in the country. It is part two of our conversation with Devin. Part one came out last week. This week was a lot about follow-up questions, questions that I got from you guys and questions that popped up for me when I went back and listened to our conversation. And so we talk about a variety of things, a couple of highlights. Devin really dives into the difference between pasture-raised, grass-fed, and conventionally farmed meat and animal products and the importance of making that distinction and the importance of knowing where our food comes from. If you're at all like me and you kind of nerd out about nutrition and health and wellness and some of the new research that's out there, you've probably heard of something called the gut microbiome. I don't know much about it. Devin knows a ton about it. We talk about the gut microbiome, what it is, why it's important for us to keep it healthy, and the connection between our gut and what we put in our body as far as nutrients are concerned, and the brain. The thoughts we think, the feelings we feel, it's a two-way street between the brain and the gut, and that was a fascinating part of the conversation. A couple other things we touch on: supplements, the validity of supplementation, what supplements you should take, how you go about figuring that out. And Devin also talks about fasting, which is a really interesting topic to me. It's something that's pretty hot right now in the fitness and medical communities. So much research out there and so many differing opinions out there as well. And so I thought getting Devin's point of view was pretty fascinating. We closed the conversation with a discussion about what's going on in the United Kingdom right now and how the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, is using his own bout with COVID and with weight gain to address the greater issue of weight gain and obesity in the United Kingdom. So without further ado, it's part two with Devin Delaney on Coming Up Podcast. All right. First time that we've done this on the Coming Up Podcast, we have a follow-up show with Devin Delaney. Dev, thanks for coming back on.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for having me back on your show. So much to talk about.
Yeah, I'm pumped. Yeah, we were just talking before we started taping about how, you know, some of the list of follow-up questions that we have, we could literally do a podcast on each one of these follow-up questions, but we're going to do our best to make it succinct, make it practical. If you are listening to Devin for the first time and you didn't catch the podcast that we did last week, I highly recommend checking that one out. Tons of great information in that pod and a lot of applicable information that we can take and use in our own lives to function more optimally as human beings, which is the goal, right? So let's get the ball rolling. One of the first questions that I received in response to that podcast was about calories and macros, proteins, fats, and carbs. And, you know, in the United States, we eat a lot of protein. Bodybuilding's a big thing here. Weightlifting's a big thing. We eat a ton of protein. I think, and I'm definitely somebody who, until very recently, you know, protein was the center of my plate for every single meal. What researchers have been learning is that a high protein diet, while it's great for your physique, isn't exactly great long-term necessarily. What are your thoughts about that?
Just kind of focusing on protein, I see why it's controversial, and I do agree that we are consuming a large amount of meat, predominantly conventional raised meat, today, and experiencing all different health effects. But I think with all of the macronutrients, it really comes down to, it depends on your body, right? And finding out what works for you. High protein diets are definitely high focus priority for bodybuilding, for physique training, but also for athletes and for people as we age, right? Protein can be fantastic for bone mineral density. So for women, especially going through menopause, postmenopause, at risk for osteoporosis, you know, we can't forget about the importance of protein. It is, its role in the body is, you know, it's an essential building block for our tissues, our bones, all of these things. There's over 50,000 different proteins in the human body. So I think that just shows how important of a macronutrient it is. We need it for our muscles and we need to build and repair. We need it to feel energized and satiated. But how much is too much? And that's where it's really that bio-individual component. So the RDA, the recommended daily allowance, suggests, you know, using 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight. I would argue that that's a little bit on the low end, just from where I see my clients feel their best. And that's really where we need to go with this. So with athletes, I like to recommend a range between 1.2 grams per kilogram all the way to 1.8. And I think this sort of bodybuilding high protein diet is probably upwards of 2.8, something like that. So it's a significant amount of protein. And I think we also have to talk about, when we're focusing on that high range, what sources are you getting? You know, are you just eating animal meat all day long? Oftentimes they're supplementing with protein shakes. And although, you know, there's a time and a place for them, especially with athletes based on your goals, there are a lot of unhealthy protein powders on the market. So we just have to be careful and make sure we're really sourcing appropriately for our overall health. But again, at the end of the day, it is a macronutrient. Our body needs it in large quantities, but let's just make sure we're getting a wide variety. You can get tons of protein from plant matter, tons of protein from legumes and nuts and seeds, and then obviously some high quality sources of animal protein as well. So just get a good variety and find out, use sort of those ranges that we talked about based on your body weight, and then just check in. How am I feeling? How's my digestive? How's my digestion working? How's my energy levels? All of those sorts of things. That would be my best answer with sort of navigating the unknown around my protein needs. Do we need it? That sort of thing.
So you touched on two things there that I want to get to. First of all, you talked about grams of protein per kilogram mm-hmm. of body weight. What is that in pounds?
Yeah, take your pounds and multiply it by 0.36. So someone who's 150 pounds, that would be 54 grams of protein. When we get into talking about all the different macronutrients, you know, I like to start with my clients on 40, 30, 30 as a percentage of your total daily calories. So 40% of your total daily calories would be carbohydrates, and then 30% of those would come from proteins, and 30% of those would come from fats for your total daily calories. That's just sort of a blank slate. Let's get you there and then make your adjustments. Some people are going to thrive off of high carbohydrate, low protein, low fat, vice versa. Some people weigh higher protein. We talk a lot about high fat diets right now. And people feeling great on those. So it's really bio-individual, but I like to start with 40-30-30. It's a simple ratio, and that sort of is a clean slate. And then we check, again, energy, sleep, digestion, all of these different things. And then your goals, too. How active are you, and what are your goals? Are you trying to lose weight? Do you have some physique goals? Are you healthy? Because if we have blood sugar issues or hormonal issues, digestive issues, we may need to sacrifice some of those physique, so to speak, goals or weight loss goals and really focus on healing the body and getting it to a place where it can take on some of these adjustments and some of your different goals, especially for athletes. We talk about that a lot. If you're training all the time, but you're experiencing some hormonal stuff or digestive stuff, we might need to ease back a little bit and go into healing mode. And then we can really push the envelope and set some athletic endeavors, so to speak, and get after those. And that's where you'll see your body thrives the most.
So staying along the same lines of protein, particularly animal protein, I know something that you're passionate about and something that I've just recently started to learn more about is, you know, conventionally farmed animal products versus grass-fed, pasture-raised. I think there's a lot of confusion amongst shoppers, like why is grass-fed important, or what exactly does pasture-raised mean versus grass-fed versus a package that doesn't have any of those things. So could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, the complexity of marketing, right? It's like these large corporations hope that they benefit from confusing the consumer. At least that's what it seems to me. So let's dive into it a little bit. In general, it's really about quality over quantity. So grass-fed, for example, ruminants like beef and lamb, buffalo, bison, goats, things that are naturally roaming around, right? They thrive off of grass and different things in nature. So when you just see grass-fed on a label, that means that some part of their lives, they were fed grass. So that's definitely better than not, right? Than conventionally or industrial raised, or if we see, you know, fed a vegetarian diet. We don't always want to see that because these animals, they eat a variety of things out in nature, bugs and different stuff in the grass too. That's important. When you see 100% grass fed, grass finished, that means these animals, this meat was fed exclusively grass. And that is sort of the highest caliber we can look for. It just means they're living healthier lives, less toxins in their meat. If you think about just a relaxed animal roaming, you know, in pasture, eating grass, their meat's going to be more tender. They're not stressed. They're not cooped up, right? They get to roam a little bit. And then research has shown too, it's not just sort of woo-woo and expensive. They're the nutrients in these meats, in the different meats are different. So higher omega-3 versus omega-6 fats in 100% grass-fed, grass-finished. And why is that important? So these are essential fatty acids that ideally we want this ratio to be about 1:1 for omega-3 to omega-6. And omega-6 ends up being a little higher. I think today our ratio sits in around 1:4 omega-3 to omega-6 because we're consuming a lot more packaged foods that have refined oils in them that are just very inflammatory. We're eating a lot of meat that meat eats grains and corn and different GMO products that increase the omega-6 content. So we're constantly trying to get that ratio and balance it back to 1:1 or as close as we can get, right? So we are seeing an importance there. Conventionally raised or industrially raised, like on a feedlot, they're going to predominantly eat grains and corn, commercial feed, all of these things that these animals don't typically eat or find in the wild. And then those foods like our grain and our corn, when they're mass produced, they have pesticides on them and fertilizers and their GMO crop. And the list sort of goes on, but we're getting further and further away from what these animals naturally eat and how they naturally live. So that's sort of the grass-fed piece. Pasture-raised, cage-free, free-range. So we're talking poultry and eggs and things like that. So cage-free simply means these animals aren't confined to cages, which is great, but oftentimes they're still in tight quarters, don't have access to sunlight and fresh air and able to eat natural diets, finding bugs and whatnot. Free range, usually these animals have access to the outdoors, but it's really vague sort of how much and into what degree. So we don't know if it's just for a super short amount of time. We don't know if the outdoor access they're getting, is it grass? Is it dirt? Is it just a big concrete square, for example, where all the chickens are crowded on top of each other. So what you really want to look for there is pasture raised. And what that means is they're grazing on pasture. They're eating bugs. They're in the sun. They're breathing fresh air. And when you see a farm that's doing it right, they will move that pasture around the property so that they're grazing on fresh fresh grass and new bugs and things like that, rather than just completely depleting one area. So it may be good for a little bit, but then all the nutrients are kind of sucked out of it. So that's sort of the difference there. And then seafood, we can't really forget about that one. So the common distinction is going to be wild caught versus farm raised. I think most of the fish that we see in our supermarkets is farm raised. And basically these fish, they're grown and sort of produced in these really small enclosures, and they're fed on natural diets. A lot of times these foods and living environments can really increase disease. And so the farmer who's raising them will need to use antibiotics to try to help fight the disease that's going on in their fish. So we really want to look for wild caught. You know, these fish are growing up in their natural habitat, swimming around, eating the food it evolved to consume. So that would be the goal there. And then also think about the food chain. So smaller fish are going to be better. And it's not always what I think our standard American diet tends to eat. So things like sardines are going to be fantastic and super nutrient rich. Wild caught salmon and tilapia, some shellfish like oysters and clams can be great. But basically, the reason why this is so important is because toxins in our ocean, they bioaccumulate. So basically they build up. So when we eat larger fish like tuna and swordfish and marlin, they're going to have way higher levels of toxins and mercury and things like that. So we just need to be careful that we're getting, you know, all the benefits of fish with great healthy fats and things like that and great source of protein, but looking for wild caught is going to be key, because we're getting to a point where when we're eating these foods, a lower quality of them, they're doing more harm than good, I would argue. That was a lot.
That's all really interesting. You know, for me, like, it's pretty simple for me to, like, find pasture-raised eggs and pasture-raised mm-hmm. poultry, mm-hmm. mainly eggs. What yeah. about beef? How do you find pasture-raised beef, and where do you shop for it?
Yeah, so in an ideal world, get to know your local farmer, your local area, but not everyone has access to that. But I think that's going to be the first place to look, and you'd be surprised. You know, a simple Google search, or there's Facebook groups as well. I'm in a new place this summer and already getting connected to kind of the local farmers market scene, and where can I get my veggies and where can I get my meat. So I would start there if you have access to it. But the other great thing with today's day and age and modern technology is businesses like ButcherBox, where you can order really high quality meat and poultry and wild caught fish basically at your fingertips, and you can get a monthly subscription. And so I would check out sources like that if you don't have access to a farmer close by, and really get to know them, you know, ask questions. And you can do the same thing to your local butcher counter at your grocery store too. Ask them where they're sourcing, ask them what they know about the meat, how long has it been there, fish as well. And just quiz them a little bit, because I think as a consumer, you deserve to know about where your food's coming from and really feel empowered to get the answers you're looking for.
All great questions to ask. All right, let's yeah. switch gears a little bit and talk about the gut, which is kind of the hot topic right now in functional medicine. And it's starting to dip into conventional medicine as well, talking about gut health and the microbiome. What is the gut microbiome, and why should we care about keeping it healthy?
Yeah, so the microbiome, people think of it as kind of our stomach area, which it is, and it's a collection of bacteria and all the stuff that lives inside your large intestine. So we really want to have a thriving, you know, diverse and robust microbiome. So when we talk about eating, I talk about eating the rainbow a lot and eating a lot of different foods. The more variety we can have, especially with plant matter, different fruits and vegetables, the more robust and healthy, thriving microbiome we have. And that's really important for a variety of reasons. On the last podcast, we talked a lot about viruses and just building up a strong immune system to fight pathogens and things like that. But also, we need it for proper digestion. also, people talk about the gut microbiome as our second brain, and it's really because it communicates to the rest of the body to perform different functions and just operate functionally, optimally, sorry. And so if we are sitting down to a big meal and we have a leaky gut and maybe we had a really stressful day, our brain can't send the proper communication to release different digestive enzymes so that we break down that food properly to a state that our body can absorb its nutrients. So we have partially undigested food moving through our digestive tract. We already said this, you know, we probably have some sort of leaky gut going on. So these food particles are basically passing through that blood-brain barrier and getting into the bloodstream. And the body sort of freaks out because it doesn't recognize these particles. And so we really need a thriving and healthy and closed system, a closed microbiome. And that way we can digest our food properly, we can absorb nutrients properly, we can fight infection and keep pathogens out. Our gut microbiomes can help build things like serotonin, which is a neurotransmitter that helps regulate our mood. So we talk a lot about this gut-brain connection, right? We talked about the connection with digestion. Now we're talking about it with mood. So it's really just, I think, the epicenter for overall health to keep the rest of our body functioning as best it can.
So what you're saying is there's a two-way street running from our gut to our brain. And
absolutely.
The health of our gut affects the health of our brain, and the health of our brain affects the health of our gut. It's remarkable.
Yes. Yeah, it really is remarkable. And they're doing so much research on, you know, how the health of your gut, and when you have good gut bacteria, how you can prevent things like Alzheimer's and different brain degenerative diseases that take place. We can stop that in its tracks when we stop focusing on just the sharpness of our brain and start looking inward at our gut and the foods we're eating and how healthy our bacteria is and all that sort of thing. So we need to shift that focus.
So one thing you talked about last week, and I guess this kind of goes into gut health as well, and really everything that we've been talking about so far, but one thing you talked about last week was supplements. Mm-hmm. And sort of the validity of supplements to supplement your whole food intake because mm-hmm. of, you know, things like mineral depletion in the soil, which you talked about last week, and depletion yeah. of nutrients in whole foods, because yeah. our soil is not what it was 10 years ago or 50 years ago or whatever the case may be. And so there's more and more conversation now about using supplements to kind of fill in the gaps.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that? And what's your take on the use of supplements?
Yeah, I think in general, I come from a place where I haven't been a big fan of taking medications, and I think supplements fall into that category a little bit. And now, sort of as I've gotten deeper on my own health journey, I think there's always a time and a place for some supplemental support. With my clients, I start with food first and using different food as medicine, like we talked about in the last podcast. Because there really are certain foods that contain an abundance of certain vitamins and minerals, and we really can start there and then see where you feel. And if you need a little bit more support, 100%, I think temporary supplement intake is a great resource. And it is, like you said, it's hard to get all the nutrients from our diets right now. Soils aren't as rich and we're not eating as many foods. Most people today get about 60% of their calories from just three foods. You know, when we think about what we buy at the grocery store, we buy and eat the same things every day. We just sort of, we talk about, oh, these food ruts, right? Or my go-tos. And it's for ease, it's amazing. But for health, we really need to broaden our horizons, expand our palates, and eat a diversity of foods and eat seasonally. That's a great way to try different things. What's in season? Oh, I've never had that before. We live in a in a time where you can have a banana in the dead cold of winter. And I don't know where they're growing, but not around here, but we have access to these foods, right? So we don't get a huge variety. So I think that's key. First, I talk about colors on your plate and eating the rainbow. This is that food is medicine. So I do a challenge with a lot of my students at school where it's called the 1-2-3 challenge. And you try to get a color on your plate, fruit or veggie, at breakfast, 2 at lunch, 3 at dinner. So this is just helping to eat a variety so that we get different minerals. But in terms of supplements, I see magnesium work great for almost everyone. A really high quality multivitamin isn't a bad idea, especially with these athletes that I work with. They're young, so they're a little bit picky. You're on the road, so you don't always have access to food that you like or food you feel comfortable with. Maybe you're in a different country. So I think having a multivitamin and then also like a greens type powder, where you're getting a lot of like dark leafy greens and algae and things, super nutrient dense. Just traveling with those, knowing when, you know, cold and flu season, when the seasons are changing, just a few things like that in your arsenal to help boost up your stores. The other thing is life is really stressful and our days are packed and we're faced with a lot of different challenges, and stress is good and bad. But one thing stress does is it totally depletes our vitamin and mineral stores. So B vitamins are huge when you're experiencing a lot of stress in your life or you feel a little bit run down or depleted. That may be a great supplement. Minerals, my go-to is just some sea salt, adding it to your food, adding it to your water. Vitamin D in the winter, you know, in the summer, the best is to get it from through your skin from the sun, going outside without sunblock for maybe 15 minutes just to up those natural vitamin D stores. But in the winter, we're pretty bundled up. And so, you know, a good vitamin D supplement is not a bad way to go. And then going back to digestive health and microbiome a little bit, digestive enzymes I've seen work fantastically for people. Just to properly break down your food and absorb those nutrients. So if we're starting to eat a more nutrient-dense diet, you want to be able to digest that. And when we have leaky gut and we're not sitting down in a rest and digest relaxed state to enjoy that meal, we're not going to absorb very much of all your hard-earned money and beautiful food that you just prepared. So I like to look for hydrochloric acid. That's going to be just natural stomach acid. So that's going to help your body give it a little bit more stomach acid to break down the food. Pepsin is a digestive enzyme that's fantastic to break down protein. So we talk about if you are having a meal that's high in protein, having a little digestive support with some pepsin will help you break it down so you can get all the fantastic benefits. And then fats. I think a lot of people today, since we grew up sort of with this fear of fat, our bodies aren't as adapted to digest it properly. And so I see a lot of clients, including myself, who need help with fat digestion. And so pancreolipase is a natural enzyme that our body produces to break down fats. So looking for a supplement that has that. And then also beet concentrate. So it goes back to that food is medicine. Just organic beets in high concentration in a supplement form, that's going to be great for breaking down those fats and producing healthy bile and things like that. So those are some of my go-tos, just basic. You know, I love a magnesium. I love a multivitamin, a greens powder on the road if you're not getting a lot of leafy green vegetables, vitamin D in the winter, pinch of sea salt in your water, and then maybe some digestive enzyme.
I keep going back to that thing you said about stress affecting mineral and vitamin levels in your body. I mean, it's amazing how interconnected everything is, you know, the mental and the physical, what you put in your body thought wise and food wise. It's just so important. So you talked a lot about seeing low levels of certain vitamins in people in different times of year or certain digestive enzymes that have worked well for people, whatever the case may be. So that brings me to my next question, which is, what are the benefits to seeing a functional nutritionist, and how does one go about finding out what they need in their body as far as nutrients and vitamins and minerals are concerned?
Yeah, a couple thoughts on that. I think the body is 100% designed to heal. It is a really intricate but brilliant system. And so what it will tell you, if we listen, it will tell you what it needs, and it will start to give you different signals. So that stress one that we just talked about, a lot of times people experience, you know, an injury, like their back will go out, or they'll have neck or shoulder pain when they're under a lot of stress. And that's a sign your body's in a, it's manifesting that stress physically where you feel pain somewhere. I guess one piece is becoming more in tune with your body and trying to listen for those signals, because there are different ways where you can help yourself or get clues without a functional nutritionist or a functional medicine doctor. But then there are so many people that have been sick for a long, long time and have not gotten answers. And when they are listening to their body and they're saying, I'm feeling this, I'm experiencing this, they're not getting heard. And so I definitely think go and get some data, you know, do a GI map where you do a stool test and you're looking at your gut microbiome. Heavy metal testing is really popular right now and is pumping out some amazing information, because there are a lot of mold toxicities that's being linked to different health issues and food sensitivities and autoimmune disorders. Vitamin and mineral levels, I think just your normal blood work, if you sort of treat that like your annual physical, that's just going to sort of give you your levels, see where you're at. I definitely recommend that for things like vitamin D, even though I think it's a great one to supplement in the winter. Know your level, know your range, and know where you're at so that you're supplementing appropriately. And then to add to that, I think especially for females, hormone testing, I think that's a great one to invest in annually as well, just to see where you're at, because it's so linked to your overall health. And that's something I wish I was doing a lot sooner. So I invest in that myself now. Food sensitivities, I think functional doctors and nutritionists can be really helpful with that. But the good old-fashioned elimination diet is going to be your best resource here. And it's free. But using these people to support you on that journey is going to be key, because it's really hard to do an elimination diet and to do it properly. But basically, you eliminate, there's the common food sensitivities, right? So we talk about gluten and dairy and soy. Eggs are up there now. Nuts are up there. So you eliminate these foods for a certain amount of time, oftentimes around 21 days to a full month, sometimes longer. And then you do a reintroduction. But it's very, it's done out in quite detailed way. You make sure that your nutritionist is supporting you so that you're not feeling depleted during this time. You're getting what you need. And oftentimes when you reintroduce these foods, you start to notice symptoms that maybe you didn't know you were living with before. So maybe skin stuff comes up, maybe stomach ache or digestive stuff comes up, brain fog, things like that. Oftentimes it takes removing some of these foods that we eat on a daily basis and think we feel fine, for us to realize, okay, maybe they're not quite right for me.
One of my final questions for you is, you know, another big thing, you talked about one of the hot topics right now is heavy metal testing and food sensitivity testing. Another hot topic is fasting. And I know you and I have had discussions periodically about fasting and your thoughts. Fasting is something I do, and I've found for myself that it's been very helpful for me in terms of like my indigestion. But I'm curious, A, how important is time as far as what time you eat and how often you eat? And conversely, what are your thoughts on time without food, aka fasting?
So I think this is a really important one to talk about. And in terms of just timing your meals, there's, in my opinion, there's not an ideal time, or you need to stop eating by 8 p.m. or anything strict like that. It's really what works for your lifestyle, but there are a couple things to keep in mind. So we want to make sure that we have proper blood sugar regulation. So we're keeping our blood sugar and our hormones and our energy stores. You know, we want to be pretty level, because when we experience big spikes and big drops, that's where issues start to happen. Our health really starts to break down, our hormones get impacted, and then digestion, et cetera. And it's just this whole cascade. So when we keep that in mind, we don't want to go too long without eating so that our blood sugar just totally plummets, that bonking kind of feeling, right? A lot of us experience that in the middle of the afternoon. Maybe we're reaching for that third cup of coffee or whatnot, or maybe a little piece of chocolate or candy. We just need a little push to get us through the afternoon. That's a hint that our blood sugar is off. Maybe we went too long without eating. Maybe our lunch, for example, if we're still talking about that afternoon window, maybe it wasn't as balanced or satiating. It didn't have enough calories, et cetera, as our body needs. So these are all signs. And the other thing would be if you're training. So pre-workout and post-workout, timing of our food is key. So we want to make sure we're not going into a workout with an empty tank. We want, you know, full stores so that we can really have an effective workout. And then we want to eat something, you know, predominantly good carbohydrates and protein within, you know, 30 minutes to an hour of that workout to really recover and restore and rebuild. So that's where I think timing is more important. With intermittent fasting, I really believe in just a natural window. So you and I talked about what's a common time people eat dinner. Maybe it's 7 o'clock and then they sleep hopefully around 8 hours, and you wake up and maybe breakfast again is around 7:30, 8 o'clock, something like that. So we're not stretching it until noon necessarily, but we're just sort of on this natural rhythm where we're giving our body and our digestive system a break. That is really where that magic is coming in with intermittent fasting. So that's sort of a sustainable, natural way that I think you can do it, and why I really like intermittent fasting. But we always sort of take things to the extreme, right? So first it was paleo, which was predominantly eating, you know, clean protein and fruits and vegetables. And now that's turned into the carnivore diet of like, I just eat meat, or keto taken to the extreme of, you know, these insane fat percentages. So with intermittent fasting, I think males experience a lot more success, because I think it comes down to hormones. They're not, their hormones aren't as cyclical, like these daily hormonal cycles as women. They're much more flat and sustained. So they're not impacted. They don't see the negative impacts of intermittent fasting as much as I see with females. And then for therapeutic uses, I really can get behind it. You know, I've seen great things. There's so much research behind eradicating, you know, potentially cancerous cells, and all these just sort of unhealthy cells in the body, for weight loss, extreme weight loss, I can see for sure. But in general, I think taking any of these sort of trends to the extreme, we notice maybe more harm than good. And there's always a population that's going to do better. And I really don't recommend it for women outside of that sort of normal sleeping, rest and digest window.
There's so much different information out there, and yeah, of course there's always conflicting points of view, and I think it goes back to what you said, which is that a lot of it depends on the person.
And if you're somebody who wants to try intermittent fasting, how would you recommend somebody get started?
Use a practitioner, work with a nutritionist. Detox is the same way, you know, it can be really powerful and beneficial, but it can be too much too fast as well. So if we just all of a sudden switch to a huge intermittent fasting window, that's going to have some negative effects. So I'm curious, Matt, when you got into it, did you sort of start slow and expand that fasting window?
I started not eating after 8, and then I would eat at 10. So it was a 14 hour. And then by the end of it, I was doing 16 hour, which is, I do between 14 and 16 usually now. I've tailored it more towards what time I go to bed and what time I wake up, because I found that I sleep a lot better if I'm done eating 2.5 hours or more before I go to sleep. I wear a tracker and I can see the difference when I'm consuming calories and stuff right before bed versus when I have that window between, you know, eating and sleeping.
Yeah. Again, it's just really, really good information on your body for sure. I think most of the research we see is done on men, and not to have a gender bias, but it's just what we see. And I think the hormonal picture for women is just completely different. So we just have to be careful. And then, and really, you know, ask yourself those personal questions. How is my digestion? You know, how is my energy? Do I feel like I could take on something like this or try this diet, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, totally. I love having these conversations. They're just so interesting to me, especially because so many people have differing opinions on fasting in particular, since we're talking about that. It's one of those topics, like we talked about at the top of the show, that we could have, you know, a 3-hour long episode just about fasting, the benefits, the drawbacks, you know, what the research says. And it is definitely one of those hot topics right now that I think a lot of people are sort of dipping their toes into it and just seeing, like, how does it make them feel and what works for them and things like that. I think you made some really interesting points. So that is it for follow-up questions, but there's one more thing I wanted to talk about to close the show. It's something that I saw in the New York Times earlier this week. Out of the United Kingdom, their Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, is using his struggle to overcome coronavirus earlier this spring and his struggle to overcome weight gain and the connection between the two. He's using that as a catalyst to get the ball rolling in Great Britain to address the issue of weight gain and obesity and the overall health of the community. Two quick things. One, he's coming up with a new policy. Advertisements for any food high in fat, sugar, or salt will be banned on television and online until 9 p.m. to avoid the hours when children are most likely to see them. And there will also be a consultation on whether Britain should entirely ban online ads for junk food. And they're also getting rid of promotional offers like buy one, get one free on fatty or sugary foods. This,
pretty
to
amazing,
me,
huh?
Is awesome. I mean, it's a great step in the right direction. And I think it's so cool that one of the top political figures in the United Kingdom is using his own struggle with weight gain and with battling the COVID-19 virus to really kind of hone in on the health issues that have gone unchecked for quite some time, but are now being brought to the forefront and attacked by coronavirus.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is such an important message, and it's that realization. I mean, I feel like, unfortunately, we sort of need to hit this rock bottom for the wake up and to really pay attention and make change. But the changes that we're seeing such as this is just so positive. And I think it's going to help. I mean, ads and marketing are huge. And I forget the statistic, but the amount of, you know, different ads and things that come across us on a daily basis, it's incredible. And in terms of the restaurants and cafes and being required to add the calorie count to their menus, we've seen this in the US for sure. And I think it's a great place to start, but I would really like to see this understanding of sourcing and how to read ingredient labels and really understanding what these different labels mean, like we talked about with the pasture raised or the grass fed, et cetera, et cetera. What are these ingredients? Rather than just straight calories. I think it helps because it creates an awareness, but I think counting nutrients over calories is where our minds need to shift in terms of overall health for sure. Because the amount of nutrients and the amount of calories, they're just not created equal. So that would be my one thought for this is a great place to start, and I hope we can get to this next step in the future.
Yeah, yeah. I love to see it from Great Britain, and I hope that we start to see something similar from the United States.
Yeah, I mean, knowledge is power. And so hopefully getting education from resources like this and books and podcasts and articles, but then also, you know, the more we have with ingredient information and calorie information and things like that, we just become more informed and empowered consumers. So that's the magic for sure.
Well, Devin, I appreciate you informing me and everyone else listening to the podcast for this follow-up episode. Thank you so much again for coming on. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Matt. I hope to see you soon.